Jews and Muslims talking together. This is Radio Salam Shalom.
A Jew's Prayer for the Children of Gaza by Rabbi Levi Wyman Kelman, printed in Haaretz. If there has ever been a time for prayer, this is that time. If there has ever been a place forsaken, Gaza is that place. Lord, who is the creator of all children, hear our prayer this accursed day. God, whom we call blessed, turn your face to these, the children of Gaza, that they may know your blessings and your shelter, that they may know light and warmth, where there is now only blackness and smoke and a cold which cuts and clenches the skin. Almighty, who makes exceptions, which we call miracles, make an exception of the children of Gaza. Shield them from us and from their own. Spare them, heal them, let them stand in safety. Deliver them from hunger and sorrow and fury and grief. Deliver them from us and from their own. Restore to them their stolen childhoods, their birthright, which is a taste of heaven. Remind us, O Lord, of the child Ishmael, who is the father of all the children of Gaza, how the child Ishmael was without water and left for dead in the wilderness of Beersheba, so robbed of all hope that his own mother could not bear to watch his life drain away. Be that Lord the God of our kinsman Ishmael, who heard his cry and sent his angel to comfort his mother Hagar. Be that Lord who was with Ishmael that day and all the days after. Be that God the All-Merciful, who opened Hagar's eyes that day and showed her the well of water, that she could give the boy Ishmael to drink and save his life. Allah, whose name we call Elohim, who gives life, who knows the value and the fragility of every life, send these children your angels. Save them, the children of this place, Gaza the beautiful and Gaza the damned. In this day, when the trepidation and rage and mourning that is called war seizes our hearts and patches them in scars, we call to you, the Lord whose name is peace. Bless these children and keep them from harm. Turn your face toward them, O Lord. Show them, as if for the first time, light and kindness and overwhelming graciousness. Look up at them, O Lord. Let them see your face. And as if for the first time, grant them peace.
Rabbi Francis Berry starting this Radio Salam Shalom podcast. It's been impossible to avoid the news of renewed major conflict between Israel and Gaza. With constant media images of bloodshed, of military action, and of funerals in both Gaza and Israel, Radio Salam Shalom asks if dialogue has a place in creating a vision of peace in the region. Tonight we explore not the history and the politics of the Middle East, and in particular Israel and Palestine, but instead we examine what dialogue actually means in the context of conflict, and who is taking dialogue forward in the face of such turbulent and bloody political times. In essence, how do we keep peace alive? My name is Peter Brill, and joining me in the studio are both Muslims and Jews from Bristol. And also joining us will be experts in conflict and dialogue from around the world. As well as dialogue, we will be talking about music, we'll be hearing music, and there'll be readings and other interviews as well. Joining me as a co-host is Javed. Javed, do you think that dialogue can work? Do you think dialogue does have a place?
I think it definitely can work and it definitely has a place, but to enable dialogue there has to be certain sort of basis for it. If there's violence going on, if there's bloodshed, then it's very difficult to have that kind of dialogue. There needs to be some sort of peace before dialogue can happen.
Well, we're going to be talking a lot about that during the next hour or so. And in fact, this is a view that's been reflected by a lot of the experts. International Alert is a UK-based international peace-building organisation, and they're working in areas of conflict around the world, in Africa, in Sri Lanka, and also in South America. Now, they have more than 130 staff in 11 field operations, and one of them is Diana Klein. She's been with International Alert for the past 6 years, having previously worked in Jerusalem, her home city, as an employee of the Thuman Peace Institute. I began by asking her how International Alert approached dialogue.
We have a dual approach. That means that we work directly with people affected by violent conflict, as well as governments and international institutions such as the EU or the UN, to shape both policy and practice in building sustainable peace.
Let's get this clear. International Alert are not working on the Palestinian-Israel conflict. Is there a reason for this?
There is no one factor to it. In the case of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we did realize that our added value in the current context would actually not be as such as to justify our engagement. And that's because there is a certain degree of violence beyond which people don't actually feel ready to engage with each other and to start building peace. That violence must subside and a certain degree of readiness is needed. Of course, there are numerous groups on both sides currently, some working alongside, parallelly, some together, who are doing their best and promoting reconciliation and supporting peace. But the impact of these groups currently is quite limited, in particular because of the high levels of violence.
It wasn't that you felt that as an organisation, International Alert didn't want to be involved in the dialogue, or that it couldn't be involved, but that it couldn't add anything to what was already happening out there.
Yes, we certainly feel that we could be involved because there is people are and groups are interested in support from an international organization, and we would love to, because that's a very, very difficult conflict that we think deserves attention and needs more engagement. However, conflict can only be addressed and peace can only be built by those people affected by conflict. We can only support, advise, guide if needed, and accompany people and processes in this very difficult task. We cannot push people towards reconciliation if they're not ready. And that readiness will not come from the outside, and it will only happen if hostilities and violence cease. I can't say that there's going to be complete cessation of violence, and it's rare for any conflict, and I can't really talk about an acceptable degree under which people will start to build peace. Since for us, there is no acceptable level of violence, but sadly, in many, many protracted conflicts, people get to a point when they learn to coexist with a certain degree of violence, and they realize that the only way to actually address conflict and build peace is through dialogue.
Many people would say this is a very depressing outlook for not just this conflict, for other conflicts, but in your own experience, there has been times when dialogue has worked.
Okay, it's less about a time when dialogue has worked. It's more about what kind of dialogue and what actually do we mean when we talk about dialogue. When International Alert defines dialogue, we mean processes where people from at least two or more opposing sides get together based on something that they have in common and keep exploring various issues. But eventually, they do get to talk about the conflict and reconciliation, and they get to address very, very difficult issues. These groups of people can be teachers, scientists, women, youth, any people who have something, at least one thing in common, and are ready to engage and talk to each other. In the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, during the height of the peace process in the 90s, there have been lots and lots of dialogue processes and groups happening. However, many of them were either one-off meetings, as in not part of a process. Many of them were something criticized and called hummus meetings, as in the critics were saying, oh, people just get together, Arabs and Jews, Israelis and Palestinians, they have hummus together and everybody goes home. As in the criticism came towards the substance of these dialogues meetings and people were saying that they're largely empty.
Is that something that you agree with?
I've seen both. I've seen meetings and processes that were absolutely incredible and dealt with very, very difficult issues and transformed people's beliefs and attitudes. And then I've seen meetings that were not very valuable because there were indeed hummus meetings. One of the fundamental things that a dialogue process needs is a connection to the political level. The same way as a political peace process needs dialogue processes supporting it. For instance, you can't have politicians negotiating and announcing a peace agreement without having the acceptance for that peace from the wider population. That is never going to bring long-term sustainable peace. People can't just switch from enemies to friends, or at the minimum neighbors who respect each other in a minute. On the other hand, dialogue processes between various groups can be really fantastic and people will be ready to talk to each other. But if nothing will happen on the political level and people will not see change on the political level, you risk disappointing people who are really, really committed to peace, especially in a context of a protracted conflict where you don't actually see change happening in a long time.
So you say that you have witnessed, if you like, life-changing dialogues, particularly in the Middle East, where there's been enormous success. Is that because those dialogues have specifically been linked to political conversation or had involved politicians themselves?
I wouldn't say that I witnessed life-changing dialogues. It was more that I witnessed a change in people's attitudes towards each other, and these people didn't actually change their political position. And that gives people hope that everything can be discussed and everything can be achieved through a dialogue without people having the fear that somebody is going to suddenly turn to something they don't want to. I change their mind completely. I have witnessed dialogues that are more successful in other contexts because they are connected to political levels, and that's why they actually are able to be a little bit more successful and achieve peace.
On the basis that currently the feelings are so polarized, not just in the areas of conflict but in other parts of the world, do you feel that there is any place for dialogue amongst communities, in this context Muslim and Jewish communities, in other countries, in other parts of the world, in Europe, here in the UK, in as much as the majority of people conducting this sort of dialogue really have no direct political influence on the situation?
Absolutely. I think that the worst thing Jewish and Muslim groups in Europe and in other parts of the world can actually do to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is to stop talking to each other. Right now, there are still people on both sides who want peace and who want a ceasefire and who are interested in reconciliation. Those people need to see that there is a certain degree of support from the outside, and those people need support. Once those people will see the support coming also from the outside, they will be empowered to perhaps act a little bit more, or we will hear their voices a little bit more as opposed to voices that just promote violence.
You have had enormous experience in other areas of conflict. Do you see any hope, any possibility that dialogue can work and any hope for resolution?
Always. I have seen other experiences where people do lose hope and suddenly there is a change and then suddenly people start talking to each other. However, we're talking about a protracted conflict. It will take many, many years and a lot of efforts to actually build that peace. And I know that it's kind of stating the obvious, but we haven't actually seen the political will on either sides to make these efforts happen and to make peace happen. So I certainly wouldn't lose hope. And I know that the situation currently is really, really grim. But if people direct their efforts a little bit towards promoting dialogue and reconciliation, even with small changes and even with small actions, I certainly think it's possible.
Diana Klein from International Alert talking to me earlier. Well, joining me also in the studio is Lisa Saffron, another expert in a different type of dialogue, really, a different approach, if you like, to the dialogue process. Lisa, tell us a little bit about that, and you also have a guest with you who's actually taken part in dialogue process with some younger people.
Yeah, I'll start with talking about a very exciting initiative at the City Academy here in Bristol. I met Richard Davison at one of my Compassionate Listening dialogue sessions where members of Radio Salaam Shalom, Muslims and Jews, have been getting together and using the techniques of dialogue and compassionate listening that I learned on a trip to Israel and Palestine with the Compassionate Listening Project. And Richard came to one of these, and it turned out that he has organized an event as part of his citizenship curriculum in secondary school at the City Academy. And I'd really like, Richard, if you would tell how this came about. It was a whole day on the Israel-Palestine conflict with students from Bristol, who are mostly Muslim students in this particular class, along with students from Devon schools.
Yes, and that was really what has happened organically for a number of things that we've been doing. I think it's standard fare in a secondary school to teach Judaism as the world religion, and indeed Islam as the world religion. Our work on Judaism as the world religion took fairly normal sort of form, but we gradually sort of evolved it into the story of a persecuted people and their hope for freedom. So we focused on things like the Passover, and ultimately that led to the re-establishment of Israel in 1948 as one kind of outcome of many, many years of persecution. Now, of course, you can't get back to Israel in 1948 without the irony of the people who were living in Israel in 1948. And we couldn't actually not address that once we got to that point in the story. And so over a number of years, the unit of work on Judaism continued to end with more of an examination of what was going on in Palestine. And of course, weekly, that's fueled by the news. It has been basically my whole life, and was when we were doing this work. At the City Academy, with a sort of brief as well of global education and international links, I always had this idea that it would be great for kids in our school to have, at the very least, written or particularly email links with students in Palestine. I met a headmaster from a Palestinian school in Bristol, the Quakers Meeting House up in Gloucester, a number of years ago, some local people, who've been very involved in Palestine dialogue and initiatives. And eventually we got, through local people, a contact with an organisation called Schools Across Borders. It actually operates from Dublin. People who work in Palestine with Palestinian and Israeli Jewish youngsters. And we ended up at a conference in Exeter, taking our kids there. And basically the event that you were involved in, Lisa, at the City Academy, was a reciprocation of that conference by having a conference of our own for them. So we are bringing Devon children from schools in Devon to Bristol to discuss Israel and Palestine, but also to meet properly for the first time in their lives and have dialogues with Muslim children of their own age.
And one of the things that I found very exciting was the dialogue, the debate that came about as a result of our the meeting of these two kids, and in which one of the students from Devon said and asked the Muslim students, why is it that, how do you feel when Muslims carry out suicide bombings? And the students from Bristol came out very clearly saying, well, we feel sad, of course. And they explained, they were able to explain how they see it. And it was a chance for a real dialogue there, I thought.
Well, absolutely. And not only that dialogue, it's always going to be about breaking down the stereotypes between the different groups of people, especially kids who don't really have an experience of living in inner cities or multicultural communities.
I thought it was a very successful day.
Yes, and you know, I must say that your role in that day was also fabulous, and the way that the kids did a workshop on your writing and your novel Checkpoint was a way of getting young people's minds focused on that issue.
Yes, what I had hoped would, and which I think did work fairly well, was that I took the novel that I've written, which has many teenage characters, and asked the students to role play, to become each character and to try to see the situation from the different points of view. And I hope it worked. It's always hard to tell, isn't it?
It's hard to tell, but I think there were moments when we had that debate at the end of it where there was some real empathy from on both sides, and I certainly hope that we will go forward from this. And, you know, we have some big ideas about meeting up with students from Palestine and video conferences with the university in Hebron, which we will organise through probably UWE or Bristol University's facilities, yeah.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Lisa and Richard, thank you very much indeed. We'll be hearing more from Lisa a little later on, and we may also be hearing an extract of some of that dialogue as it took place in the classroom when we start to talk about exactly what dialogue actually is happening. So thank you both for joining us for that, and a very, very positive step forward here in Bristol with the younger generation. We're going to go to some music, because music, it is said, is something that heals and is a great healer, and this is something that has been written specifically for us here at Radio Salam Shalom.
Looking at my life, what has it all been for? What is the purpose of my life? If you don't hear the words I feel that I am here to give about the way that we could live. Look at you and me, I'm asking you to change what happens when we disagree. It's crazy, 'cause the pain we cause each other needs to end. Can't we be friends? Take a chance, make peace our dance. Don't let it be too late to see. To lose, so much is lost. Come on, it's time. You know we have to choose. Tomorrow, it can't be as it has been. We must move on and live the dream. Take a chance, make peace our dance. Don't let
Jews and Muslims talking together. This is Radio Salam Shalom.
Back in the studio with Shabana and Javed, and looking at dialogue and actually where perhaps it has succeeded in other parts of the world in previous years. So, Shabana, tell me a little bit about our next guest.
Obviously, today's podcast is all about dialogue, but what we really need to talk about is, does it work, has it worked, and how did it work? We are joined, Javed and myself, are joined by Kyle Hannan, the lovely, lovely station manager of Radio Salam Shalom, who, I believe, correctly, was very much involved in South Africa during these absolutely pivotal times where dialogue was at the very forefront of politics.
Yes, thank you. I was a student at the time protesting against a government that we didn't agree with, and dialogue was just not something that was happening. But it was really the only thing we had ahead of us, because otherwise it was either that or civil war.
I was going to ask you, Carl, how easy was it to have dialogue in those circumstances when you've got one sort of people being oppressed by another and not having the sort of same sort of rights and stuff? So was it a fairly easy thing to do?
The trouble is, the people who were in power weren't keen on talking. The people who were down on the ground realised that someone had to. And that's the challenge. How do you take the dialogue upstairs?
And how did you?
One of the most important things was having the choice of people to vote for a start. Because I've always believed that the vote is one of the most important things you can have. If you can't get your politicians and your representatives talking, then no matter what you do on the ground, you're not going to get very far. Dialogue has to sometimes be pushed upstairs. So there's protest. The smell of tear gas and the barking of Alsatians and, you know, the police helicopters in the air trying to keep you from having your say. But then there's the vote. And provided there's a system in place to allow you to take the opinion of the many upstairs to the representatives, who are very few, provided there's that in place, you can start pushing them in the right direction.
You briefly mentioned demonstrations, but what else did you guys do as students to really promote this idea of dialogue?
You've got to give people a place to talk. And, you know, students are lucky. They've got meetings they can have. They've got halls. They've got places that, you know, you can sit down. You can have your dialogue there. You've got your own environment. And I think as students, you're able to do things that the average man in the street isn't. And I think we're lucky. That's why if you look back in the history of protest in many countries, it normally starts on campuses, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Dialogue is obviously about talking, but more importantly, it's also about listening. As students, you've said you've had this space to talk, but did you feel that you weren't being heard by the people who perhaps needed to listen to what you were saying? How did you try and make that transition from staying inside these small student rooms to actually going out there and talking to the politicians, the leaders, the so-called people who had all this power?
One of the most useless things is a big protest that goes absolutely nowhere, because that is completely futile. And you have to make sure that you have a sense of why you're talking, and you're talking to people who you feel might be able to take it to places you can't. You've got to find representative groups, people who have a constituency, people who represent the people you want to be in that dialogue with. You know, it's all very well to have dialogue, but it's not all about giving everyone the opportunity to shout, because otherwise nothing gets heard, except everyone shouting at the same time. Someone at some stage has got to sit and listen.
How did your ideas work with those around you who perhaps were shouting? Were you quite independent from them, or did you feel that they want the same things we want, but the way they're going about it is very, very different? How did you engage with the other people who want the same thing?
Things move at a pace. You get talking, things start to roll, and then at some stage you've got to say, well, now it's over to someone else. And I think you've got to hand over responsibility to those people who really in the thick of it when you can't always be.
Mass movement is definitely something which is quite key. The situation in South Africa, it wasn't just about the South Africans doing something, it was very much a global movement. How important do you think it is to have this global support?
We were talking and people didn't believe we were. That's one of the big things. As a white South African, I would go overseas and people would go, you're a white South African. Obviously, you hate black people. And I go, no, I don't. I'm at protests. I'm trying to push for a change of government. They go, well, you're white, so you're an oppressor. And sometimes, you know, the most difficult dialogues are not with you know, the people in my own country, but those people who refuse to see that things can change.
Through dialogue and through the vote and through the global pressure, things did change in South Africa and the apartheid ended. How do you feel about what the current situation is in Israel, in the Middle East, between Israel and Palestine? Do you think dialogue could work there? And how do you think there could be peace in the Middle East?
You remember in South Africa we had something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which at a very important time in our history got people sitting around and talking to each other. And they were often people who you were used to thinking of as terrorists, people who you'd been told were going to kill you. And they were sitting down talking to people who they'd been told were going to kill them. So everyone got a sense of sitting down to talk to the enemy. But the fact that they were in the same room and talking was the most important thing. I would say that you ask where this might help for what's happening in the world around us. I always think that talking is always better than fighting. Because once the soldiers go home and the smoke clears, what are you left with?
Kyle Hammond there, talking to Shabana and Javed. Thank you for that, Kyle, and also to Shabana and Javed. We're going to be talking more to you very shortly. But first of all, a little bit more music. The time has come for peace, which I think is fairly appropriate, really. And peace, child Israel.
Muslims talking together. This
is Radio Salam Shalom.
Indeed it is, Radio Salam Shalom, with a podcast about dialogue and everything around it. So we've heard from a range of people here in Bristol. Now perhaps is the time to hear from some of the people outside the circle here in Bristol itself. And we've had a lot of communication with people around the world, people who talk to us on a regular basis, people who we actually haven't heard from for a while, and some people who we've never heard from before. But all of them have been sending in messages about their views on the situation, their views of dialogue. Joining me is Valerie, Daniel and Lisa again with some of those views. Valerie, if you would like to start off.
That's right. This is from the Common Ground News Service, which is an organization in Washington, D.C., the formal name of which is Search for Common Ground. And this is the piece on what's happening in the Middle East. The siege of Gaza could consolidate extremist leadership in the Palestinian territories in the same way that Israel's 2006 attacks on Lebanon strengthened Hezbollah. The attacks undermine the development of moderate leadership in Gaza and the West Bank as moderate leaders look impotent to their people in the face of Israel's attacks. Since only moderate leaders in Gaza are willing to look at a future of coexistence with Israel, one wonders with whom Israel expects to negotiate in the future. Israel's military strategy will make security that much more difficult to achieve. The same is also true for the prospects of more moderate leadership in Israel. Hamas's attacks make it more difficult for moderate Israeli politicians to negotiate for peace. Hamas's rocket attacks ensure that Palestinians will remain isolated and cut off from international support. The rockets prolong the Palestinian wait for a homeland and for their legitimate human rights. Achieving both Israel's goal of security and Hamas's goal of land and human rights for Palestinians requires a better, smarter strategy. The recipe for peace and security comes not from one-sided plans. Rather, it requires equal attention and empathy from both sides. An effective strategy must acknowledge legitimate grievances present in the narratives on both sides. Both Palestinians and Israelis have a historical legacy in the region. Both know what it is like to be a people without a land and share the passion to retain what they see as their land. Both feel victimized by the other. A smarter strategy would be for Hamas to recognize Israel's right to exist and safety, and for Israel to recognize and address the economic and political fuel of desperation among Palestinians. Palestinians need a state, freedom of movement, and international assistance to create jobs. Public opinion polls show there are plenty of people on both sides who support these steps. It's time the United States and the international community stood behind Israeli and Palestinian moderates, rather than allowing themselves to be distracted by the militants on both sides who search for an elusive military solution to this political and economic problem.
So a very balanced view there of the conflict and of dialogue as well. Daniel, you have a very personal view, I think.
Yeah, this is from Asif Rolef bin Shaha, I hope I pronounced his name right. He says, "I am an Israeli. I am an Israeli, and I've been living in the UK for the last 10 years, and I'm going back to live in Israel this summer. Crap timing, I know. And I am an angry Israeli. I am angry with Palestine and the Palestinians for perpetrating their victimhood and trauma and allowing for extreme violent sects to terrorize themselves and others. With their acceptance and embracing of violent means of protest that include suicide explosions, non-selective missile shooting into civilian areas, and instilling fear and hatred in the name of Islam in their children. I am angry with Israel and Israelis for not seeing that we are no longer victims but have become abusers and perpetrators, for not seeing how we are still blinded by our traumatized past and react like any PTSD victim from an underlying distorted perception of urgency, that the fact we understand war to be the only way out of this horrible situation results from generations of disassociation, of being hunted and shamed and dehumanized. I am angry that we fail to see that we are now doing the same, creating a nation that is disassociated, hunted, shamed and dehumanized, that we fail to see that we are the Palestinians, that they are us. This is a troubled family. The two brothers are hitting each other, not because one is inherently evil and the other is a victim, but because both have been exposed to and exposing the other to ongoing trauma. Punishing the other, as the media here does, is missing the point. When a family expresses severely disorganized patterns of attachment, What is called for is a slow, non-violent external intervention aimed to rebuild secure attachment to all its members. I am asking you to practice a more humanistic, mature response and love us both. Love the disturbed nation of the Palestinians with its violent sides. Love us Israelis and help us to be more mindful of how our traumas result in traumatizing others. Love us despite of our violence, despite of our behaviors. Love us because you too historically have been both victims and abusers, and you should know better than choosing sides. You should know that healing comes through relationships, through cultivating attachment, not through shaming and hate. Only when you can recognize both Israel and Palestine inside of you, not just the convenient weaker side, would you stand a chance for intervention that might lead to ceasefire, to licking the wounds, and then maybe, within a few generations of non-violent communication, to peace.
Clearly an angry young man, but a very articulate angry young man, and a very powerful piece from him. Thank you for that, Daniel. Lisa, we have something from you as well.
This is a message from the Solha Peace Project in Israel. They say, we are mourning the loss of lives and are praying for the safety of our friends who are in danger in both Gaza and southern Israel. We pray that both peoples come to the true compassion and forgiveness towards the other. With the only news coming from the Holy Land being about the war, we send some news of another picture from the Holy Land. Though we Palestinians and Israelis who work together for peace are being tested more than ever, the relationships we have built stay strong. The Solha Peace Project continues to aspire to create a new reality and to prepare the people in the region for a life of mutual respect and trust. Not that long ago, in August, thousands of Israelis and Palestinians met for the 7th annual On the Way to Solha gathering on the grounds of the Leitron Monastery near Jerusalem. The Solha Peace Project worked in full partnership with the Palestinian organization Al-Tariq to plan the event. Israelis and Palestinians came from all over the Holy Land and included 200 Palestinians from the West Bank cities of Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah, and Hebron. Our partners in Gaza, who have been with us at previous events, sent messages of blessings and support from the people of Gaza. The Solha family, Israelis and Palestinians, continue to meet, planning events to heal the wounds and rebuild trust between our peoples. After the riots in Akko between Arabs and Jews last Yom Kippur, we organized a peace tent there with 2 days of bridge-building activities. We met recently for a Shabbat in Jerusalem to support each other during this time. Anyway, it goes on to say a lot of their activities, and it really ties in with what you read just before, Daniel. So there is some healing going on.
And clearly we're going to be talking more about what is actually going on very shortly. But for the moment, Lisa, thank you very much indeed for that. One of the recurring themes is this issue of people being torn between the head and the heart and their own feelings and what they know should be right. And sometimes, as we'll discover, that can be difficult.
When I say salam, everyone say shalom. Salam! Salam!
Jews and Muslims talking together.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.
אפשרי גם כאן, לא רק בפריס או בניס או באבא באדיס קוטקים מלאים אנשים, כולם דאנסים כי כולם מצודים, מחייכים רוקדים שרים בשלום מברכים, כי יש שלום סלם פיס, 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 אפשרי גם כאן, לא רק בפריס, בתוניס או בניס ניס ניס,
האויבים נניס, האיבן אמיס, האימן אביס, אהבה נפיץ. אף אחד לא רוצה למות, אבל אם כבר חייבים, אז לא עדיף בליבייס, במקום במדים, בעזרת העצב, נחפף את העצב, כולם יכולים לרקוד עכשיו, לחיות בתוך הקצב, יאו. אפשרי גם כאן, לא רק בפריס או בניס או באמסטרדם, אלא גם כאן אנשים חופשי, הולכים עושים טאי צ'י, פותחים תיבה ולא פוחדים מצד של מילואים, כי שלום זה יותר מקץ קרבות או מנתח או משטח. שלום זאת הרגשה, אבל זה לא חדש לבטח. כן, שלום זאת. שלום זאת שלווה. שלום זה פנן, כל העולם שענן. אז אל תגידו יום יבוא, הביאו את היום, ובכל הכיכרות הריאו לשלום. שלום סלאם פיס, שלום סלאם פיס, שלום סלאם פיס, שלום סלאם פיס, שלום סלאם פיס. אפשרי גם כאן, לא רק בפריס או בניס או בבוסטון, של מילים לא יוכלו לי להסביר כמה שצריך שלום, כמו אוויר. צריך שלום כמו אוויר. צריך שלום כמו אוויר. فكر هذا انه واضح للكل انا كنت وانا شوف باستراليا الناس عايشين سبابا وكيف لا اني زايل كانغو زايل كوالا في كل العالم دوله مع سلام يا دوله سبابا ودوله بدون دوله خربانه وشو القصه الكبيره انا مش عارف كل اللي لازم نسوي نتصرف زي بني ادمين وبش زي الحيوانات תראו חבר'ה, צריך שלום, וזה כבר די ברור לכולם, אני חושב. אני הייתי, אני ראיתי. באוסטרליה אנשים נראים טוב, הם נראים כמו קנגורו, הם נראים כמו קואלות. ובכלל, ארץ עם שלום זה ארץ סבבה, וארץ בלי שלום זה ארץ חרבן. אז מה הסיפור הגדול אני לא מבין? סך כל מה שצריכים לעשות, זה להתנהג כמו בני אדם, לא כמו חיות. לגלות טיפה יותר דרך ארץ. אז שיהיה לכולם.
Muslims and Jews talking together. This is Radio Salam Shalom.
Indeed it is. Javed, it's been an interesting journey through the fact that dialogue does exist, dialogue can happen, and there's all sorts of different techniques of dialogue. But I think one of the things that's run through it that we've discovered is that people have to want to have dialogue. We've heard from experts who've been part of dialogue process around the world, but it is this thing that comes back to people wanting to have dialogue.
I think so, and it has to come from the people, from the grassroots level, I think, because you can get involved in politics and, you know, in more the people that run the place, you could get involved in that, but I think it needs to come from the people itself. They would want to have dialogue, and their voice needs to be heard. I need to say this because I was especially touched by Rabbi Berry's prayer, and I think that was really very, very nice. And he used some very kind words there. So I just want to say thank you to him on air.
That was a prayer that was written and published in Haaretz, actually, not by Rabbi Berry, okay. but he picked that up, and really it was an incredibly powerful prayer, and demonstrates that actually there is a desire on both sides, I think, for dialogue, and a desire and an understanding of the issues that are involved. Robin Sclafani is the director of CEJI, the Centre Européen Juif d'Information. They are a Jewish contribution and cultural organisation based in Brussels, who have had a lot of involvement in stimulating dialogue between Muslims and Jews across across the whole of Europe. She had this to say about the importance of dialogue.
Our mission is to make a Jewish contribution to an inclusive Europe, and as a European-level NGO, we may be having lots of activities at local level, but usually it's through national or local partners. And over the last few years, we've been focusing a lot of our efforts on a new program on religious diversity and anti-discrimination. So how can we bring believers and non-believers together in the dialogue in a secular context to deal with issues related to the religious dimension of intercultural relations? In fact, I would say right now the dialogue efforts have to weather the test of strength. We started doing Jewish-Muslim dialogue really actually out of a witnessing of increasing anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And we were seeing that through our education programs, feeling that in our relationship with partners and the feedback we were getting from national actors on the ground, that how do we deal with this? There's also political matters involved here, and we're not able to talk about these political matters. How do we deal with the tensions and the conflicts that come up as a result of these political matters? So our efforts in Jewish-Muslim dialogue started several years ago in that vein, and they went forward very well. And I think that what's been happening over the last few weeks really is a challenge to us. Seiji's position is really a calling to our partners, Muslim and Jewish, to take a stand together and not be name-calling and to not let the good relationships built over the last few years deteriorate. But really our position at Seiji is dialogue is a means, not the end, and cooperation is really the evidence that dialogue is working, that we can be in solidarity together when there are tough times on one side or the other, that we can, as Jewish organizations, stand up against Islamophobia and as Muslim organizations stand up against anti-Semitism. And we have a meeting scheduled here in Brussels of the Executive Committee of the Jewish-Muslim Platform for cooperation, and this is the main point on the agenda. Where does the dialogue stand now in the wake of Gaza? What is going on locally in your dialogue efforts? Are you standing up together? Maybe we might not be able to come up with a common political statement, but what can we take a statement about in terms of our relationship with each other and around what negative repercussions there are on the peoples here where we're living?
That's Robin Sclafani, director of Seiji. And that brings us to the end of podcast 8 here on Radio Salam Shalom. Coming up in podcast 9, we're going to continue the dialogue, we're going to continue the debate, and we're actually going to be looking at who are the people that are taking dialogue into the politics of Israel and Gaza.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.